Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an x-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Ed.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Sharon.
Hey. And today on the show, we are talking about season four. I was about to say series. Who says series? Season four, episode 9, Obstruction of Justice, which to me sounds like an NYPD Blue or Criminal Minds, do you know what I mean? Law and Order
police
episode.
That's kind of rather than ER. Yeah, like a
definitely,
police procedural.
Yeah.
Just need that dick off.
Yeah.
Nice.
We all good though. We all happy and ready to go.
We're ready to go. This is an interesting episode. A lot happens.
Yeah.
I got to jump straight in because I'm a bad person that jumps straight to the head of the queue. God, arrest me, like Carter. In a way, it was a very disjointed episode. Not in a bad way, but it was more like there was a lot of little vignettes going on in the episode.
Connection kind of between stories or even departments. It felt like surgery was very surgery and ER was ER and whatever was happening outside was very outside. And even in the ER, it was like this room where Jeannie is, things are happening and she's interacting with Weaver, but this person's interacting with, I completely see that.
But we get more Herb Spivak. Why can't I say his name? Get more Herb.
Love him so much.
I used to think he was sleazy and just be like, oh, I don't like this guy. But now I'm just...
Now I think he's great.
He should be in every episode.
I mean, he knows his stuff. It's not like he's walked in there and gone, you know, he wants so, you know, Mark has allowed this weird, strange payment of letting him kind of shadow him. And he comes in and we're all obviously a bit worried, but then he's just like telling Doyle what to do, you know, giving advice here, saving lives there. It's just like, you know what, of everybody you could let into the ER with no training, he's probably not the worst, you know.
I mean, yeah, Cynthia could get a hand, get stuck in when she's not taking kids to look like Bratz dolls from the 90s.
Oh, God, how scary.
Yeah, that was just a bit...
Should we start with Mark, then? Is that what...
That's actually, yeah,
I think
great.
That's where we're going. So we see Mark, and he's in the doctor's lounge, and we're getting a bit of an eye into kind of the world him and Cynthia are living, which seems to be very heavy in margaritas and pleasure and fun. Which seems to be taking a bit of a toll on him as he's got a hangover this morning, and he fell asleep here as well last night before, you know, he could enjoy his present that he brought for her.
Yeah, and so his relationship here with Cynthia, there's moments where it's like, oh, they actually are a really nice, cute couple, and they're, you know, that kind of the early days of it's almost electric to be around each other, and it's really nice. And then there are moments, just the obvious one that will get you now at the end, but there's just moments of they're not on the same page here. They're not on the same wavelength. And they're certainly at different stages of, the first word jumping to my head is maturity, but that might sound a bit negative against Cynthia. I don't mean it to be that way, but like certainly Mark
is. I think what you're trying to say with maturity is not necessarily an age thing, but a experience of relationship. She seems, you know, she's very all in already and expecting a lot, and he's kind of seeing it more as a light thing. And it's not against her, because, you know, he did buy her a diamond necklace and he hasn't really helped himself, like with the letter and all the stuff. But I think is that what you kind of more meant?
That's it. Yeah, like she has this, or seems to have this idea of what they are, and he is feeding that with these gestures he's making, which for him might be like, there's a diamond necklace, now leave me alone for a while.
Sort of placating and kind of going, just
excellent,
and it's
excellent
having
word,
the opposite kind of effect. I think I'd have to agree and be a bit harsh that in this episode is evidence that there is a maturity difference, or I don't want to say sophistication, because that's more judgmental somehow, but you're right, her emotional maturity is not where Mark's is, despite his whole mess from half this season.
Yeah, his childishness and behavior. Yeah.
But
he's a dad, you know, and she's not, and she doesn't have kids. And
attending. Do you know what I mean? It's a responsible position.
And like,
that's actually interesting because Mark in this episode, it's like you almost tend to forget he's an attending. Like he is there with Weaver in terms of, you know, responsibility, but sure, he is just floating, just floating through the ER, floating through his job. Like I would be at this point in time, I would be quite worried if there was some sort of, say, an emergency that required, you know, an attending as opposed to, like, we know he can handle himself in a trauma, which he does in this episode quite well. But, you know, if there's something, well, do you know what, actually? Imagine it was him who was having to deal with the Jeannie Boulay situation. I think that would just be, it's bad enough as it is. I don't think Mark should be anywhere near it.
No, and I think it's really interesting that actually he doesn't even get involved because, you know, as much as Weaver's kind of that side of it, it's still his ER too.
Yeah.
And if something huge like that is happening, I felt like that's where Mark should at least have some oversight or be a bit like, can I support you in any way or just something? But he's just so removed from it all. And I just think that just shows kind of where he is in this kind of, I don't know, just in his mind frame. He's just not there.
Yeah.
Is how I feel. So, yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, do either of you think also it's massively responsible for him to be hungover and margaritas and very little sleep due to
100%
rounds of sex with Cynthia?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I think this is something I think we've covered before on the pod. The idea of, you know you have a shift in the ER tomorrow, should you be allowed to go out and have a party? Now, I don't know, but this the theory of, let's say you are hanging coming in the next day and it's been a, you know, a birthday party or whatever, but let's say there was a special occasion and you've gone out, you've got absolutely twisted, you've slept it off, you are legally okay to work, but you are not firing on all cylinders. You are, your reaction time is down, and potentially, you know, you're altered to the point where your decision making is not where it should be. And then, as often happens in ER, 12 car pileup on the road. All right, Grant, we need, not only do we need you at your most medically most competent, but we need you mentally competent as well, because you might be having to run between several different traumas, you know, one. And I think, you know, not saying no doctor should ever be allowed to have a drink between shifts, because that's obviously not realistic, but he comes in this morning, he's hanging and he's taking tablets and everything, and all he has to do, all he has to do is bump the wrong person, and that's a malpractice suit.
And I think as well, you know, it's about his seniority in there as well. It's like, if there is a 12 car pileup, it's not like he'll just be, you know, a lower down doctor doing bits here and there. He will have to be running them and trying to coordinate it, and you need to be your best for that. So I think I just feel like it, you know, it's a real, it's showing where he is. He's still not 100% back to him, and he's still not 100% committed back to the ER. You know, this ER that he gave up, you know, his wife and a child for, and now he's kind of just not even there. It just, it's just not the best kind of version of Mark we're seeing.
No, he'll get there.
He will. And it, as we say, it's good to kind of, you know, explore these kind of highs and lows of each doctor, and kind of on bad decision making. You know, he's made this pact with Herb to that Herb can, you know, shadow him. And it seems a bit like the, he hasn't really thought about specifics with Herb, because Herb gets in there and he's like practically ready to cut somebody open and, you know, do all these things, and Mark keeps trying to temper him, and it's like, it just feels a bit like he didn't think it through and say, right, these are the ground rules at any point. He's just kind of said yes to him, which, you know.
Yeah, like, I mean, he could have, in theory, he could have gone, okay, Herb, you're coming in on, you know, Saturday, or Sunday, the 21st of November, no problem. And then, you know, have a plan. You will follow me in this, you will follow me in that, you know, as much as is possible with the ER, things change all the time. But instead, he's set himself up for a fall here. Like, you know, I have to have this person shadowing me. No one's allowed to know that this person is shadowing me. And, you know, how do I get around this? And yeah, it's a bit like, Mark,
and the kind of person Herb is as well, because he's not, like he says so many times, you know, you're not kind of hiding, you're being very obvious and loud, and you know, he's very much, he will, if somebody says, are you a doctor, go yes, and walk into a trauma and start treating people. He's not like, I don't know, somebody else who would be a bit like, no, I'm not, I'm here just to look, you know. He's very much, yes, I'm a doctor, which he says to many different people, and walks around with that authority. You know, he's telling Doyle how to, you know, how to treat the lack, and he's you know, giving advice here and there, and people often say to, oh, there's a doctor, you know, hello doctor, and he's like, yep. You know, and it's, well, just...
he's very clever. When people ask if he's a doctor, he doesn't answer directly.
Yeah.
He just sort of says, oh yeah, that's a great suture, and just do this and irrigate it. And Doyle knows what she's doing with the suturing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just kind of, yeah, he's slippery, isn't he? He's very evasive.
He's clever. He knows. Yeah, yeah. He knows how to get himself out of, you know, if something had happened, I can imagine him being like, well, at no point did I say I was a doctor, you know.
Exactly.
And at no point did I impersonate.
Why'd you let this unqualified, you know, uncertified person do this? I never said I was a doctor.
Yeah, I will. And I'm what's a qualification? Let's look at qualification. I can do, you know, brings in his pig's foot, sits there in front of the jury doing the sutures, you know.
Yeah.
Which is what Mark gives him. He says, oh, here, do some sutures. And that keeps him busy for about 2 seconds. And then he's already done and he's ready to kind of cause trouble. He finally agrees, you know, Mark agrees to allow him to do counter-traction on one patient. And then Mark also sees him just take a chart and start walking, and he has to chase him down.
That gas is just like, because I loved his little boyish excitement when the counter traction happened. He's like, oh my God, this is amazing, this is wonderful. And Mark's kind of like, we just fix an arm, but yeah, that's cool. That makes it, if you're
happy. Yeah.
I love that when when you see him walking toward the charts, you're just like, Herb, what are you doing?
Yeah. That's what I love. I love that, you know, because again, he's so brazen. You know, he will just pick one up and he will go and happily try and treat somebody. And he, and then he's walking past the room where Mr. D is dying, basically. And he comes in, and while, you know, Mark's trying to get everything ready and says, get the paddles, he ends up actually, you know, charging them and using them and saving the life, which is great. But, you know, again, even in a stressful situation, you can't trust that he's going to stand by and do as he's told. He's going to get himself in there, isn't he?
Yeah.
We have that lovely moment where the doctor, the Mr. D is being wheeled upstairs, and he sees him and he says, that's the doctor that saved my life.
I know. Poor Mr. Dyingdorfer. It was lucky. It was just a slight arrhythmia. Do you know what I mean? He was able to shock it back into rhythm.
Oh. And all the way through, what I think is so funny is that Mark keeps going, okay, tell me about my case, and he's just like, it'll be fine, it'll be sorted, and he won't give him the answers until he's finally saved a life and done a procedure. Then he says, oh, it's all sorted, don't worry, it's gone, you don't have to worry about it. And I thought, again, that was a very clever, you know, if he told him that at the beginning of the day, he'd be gone already, wouldn't he? So.
Yeah,
exactly. And he knows what he is, because when Mark finally says, right, you're done, he's like, I've had my fun. That's fine.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to do. This is actually better than I expected. You know, I got to save a life, you know, that was.
Yeah.
And then Mark's got the other things to contend with. So we hear early on that Rachel's coming in because she's got a dentist appointment, and also Carter gets arrested. So Green every so often uses that as an excuse as to why you can't do things, but doesn't actually seem to do anything for Carter, but we'll get on to that. But yeah, he ends up asking Cynthia to take Rachel to the dentist, because he's got to deal with Carter things. And again, he walks off and doesn't really seem to deal with Carter things anyway. And then Jen obviously comes in, and this is where I think Mark is really bad, because he says to Jen, oh yes, yeah, the desk clerk has taken her, she loves kids. He doesn't at any point say we're romantically involved, this is the woman I'm seeing, you know. He omits that, and I think that is so bad of him.
You're so right. And actually, I'm thinking, like, say if I'm co-parenting with somebody, I would prefer to know that someone who you know very well, you know, like that you trust, has, you know, well, not custody of my job, but you know what I mean, you know, is taking care of our kid, as opposed to, oh, the desk clerk. I was like, What do you mean the desk clerk has taken
her? Wouldn't you as well be so annoyed if you found out afterwards that this person meant more to your partner as well, like that they didn't tell you? It's like with me and you, how we have Ed and he's our custody child.
Yes, exactly.
Sometimes I send him off and I don't tell you that actually these are that person I've sent him with.
Hang on, he's not allowed anywhere without you. You have to be holding his hand.
That's true.
He could be one of those leash kids. He'll only when he puts a harness on the child.
Reins. Oh,
yeah, exactly.
Awful, aren't they?
You say that, but you know what? With my nephew, we had to have them because he just had no... He just didn't have any, that's a road, or, I need to stop. It was just the only way to make sure he was safe, because he just wasn't one of those kids. You get different kids and kids can be quite aware as to he was never like that. So we had to with him.
To be honest, I don't think they're a bad thing, because you know you can still go for your kid can walk and has within a few feet of freedom, which I think is good, as opposed to being stuck in the buggy the whole time or then as you say you're kind of like, oh crap, now I have to run after the no, you don't need to run after that dog.
And then we see they finally Sin, which is what I've been calling her, comes in. Comes back.
She's deadly.
She is. She comes in late. She's come back late with Rachel, and she's brought, as you say, she's brought her back, and this is where we see that lack of maturity. She didn't understand that how old Rachel actually is, 8, and she's gone and given her this kind of makeover that would probably be more suitable for kind of a 14, 15 year old, with coloured hair and makeup and just dyeing her hair, as a really mom and a mom of a girl, that would be terrifying to see.
It was like the I don't know if it's hair extensions or her own hair at the back. It reminds me of a cross between a Bratz doll and kids who go to beauty pageants. Do you know what I mean? Where they have that ridiculous poofy sort of feathery hair and it's just
faked. Obviously Jen's not happy, which I completely get.
I hate saying the words. I see Jen's point.
That really hurt him. You should have seen his face when he said that.
I feel really bad. If I ever meet Christine Harness, I feel really bad. I feel like I'm really sorry. It's Jen who I've problem with, not it's, Christine Harness. She might
be like, thank you. That's actually really that shows that I did my job. She might be really pleased to say that. Yeah. I mean, she has got a restraining order against you. I don't know if you know about that because of
I don't think I'll ever be able to legally meet her.
But, and then we have, because also with Cynthia, what we've had earlier as well is we've had this moment where he was tied in the doctor's lounge. She does, and she shows him to cheer him up. She kind of shows him that she's wearing the lingerie, and she's so giddy and young and just trying to, I feel like he's on her mind 24/7, where she's not on his mind more than maybe an hour or 15 minutes here and there, And I think that's what, because you just see her whole living for him, and he's just not that way at all. And also, he doesn't kind of say anything to Jen, like, oh, come on, Jen. He doesn't back Cynthia in any way or do anything like that. He kind of lets Jen get mad and walk out, and he stands back and kind of allows that to happen, which is also a bit of a crappy thing to do.
Definitely.
Yeah, he's so kind of willowy. Yeah. Or something in this. He's just like, this kind of stuff is happening around him and he's not really, getting involved or as much as possible. And if he had said, now, not that Cynthia deserved a given out to, but if he had been like, listen, you should have checked with us first. I appreciate maybe he's got caught up in the moment. I appreciate, it's kind of hard to say no to an 8-year-old, when we're having fun. But look, kind of her mom was coming. This was going to be a bit of a shock. And it is a bit... If he had had the wherewithal to go to that, it's like, this, I'm not giving out to you. I'm just like, can you appreciate that this was a bit of a surprise to walk into?
Yes.
Exactly.
But instead, it's like, oh, it's fine. It's all fine. Everything's fine. I don't want to have a real conversation with you. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
And even then, because Rachel's going back with Jen, I don't have to deal with this. That's fine.
Yeah.
Jen is the one who has to tell Rachel to wash it out of her hair. Jen
just
is the
be
one
the baddie.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not fair. It's not fair at all for him. And again, this is like, as much as there is Jen hate, this is what her parenting was like with Rachel from the beginning. She's always had to be the one to do all the actual parenting while Mark kind of went, oh, I'm at the ER, I'm busy. Which, is a tough role, because you want to be able to enjoy your kids as well and not be seen as the dull parent who always says no. So Mark is just not handling this very well at all. Because then the next thing he does is he says to Cynthia, you know, she's like, oh, you know, margaritas tonight. And he says, oh, no, my body needs a rest. And it might be that. But obviously to somebody like Cynthia, she thinks I've done something bad. This is about me, you know, which we see later, don't we?
Lack of emotional, and I keep saying maturity, I think it is, that it's that thing of, my boyfriend's mad at me, we must be breaking up. And I totally get that gut, somebody's not, doesn't want to do something with me, they must be angry with me, or they're upset with me, or whatever.
Yeah, it feels very young and inexperienced, you know.
It does a bit, doesn't it? And it's like, yeah, this, do you know what it is? It's a real teenage thing. It's a real, like, kind of my first boyfriend kind of thing. You know, I must do everything right. I must please him in every way. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to make your partner happy. Nothing wrong with that at all. But for her, I mean, actually, it is a sacrifice, and it's also a physical sacrifice, because she says, and it's a real kind of, and I'm going to use the word pathetic, but I don't mean it in an insulty way, but the way she, at the end of the day, it's like, I wore your present for you all day and my feet are really sore. And it's like, I don't think she has the manipulation in her that she's saying this to manipulate him. It's like, I did this for you today. Was this wrong? Yeah. Do you know? And it's just like, kind of heart fucking broke for you there for a second, you know?
They
have the talk in the doctor's lounge where she's like, I'm so sorry. And then again, she comes up to the van after he's bailed on their, they had planned for the night. She was there dressed in, you know, sexy lingerie and everything for him for the whole day. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to go home. Not that he's required and he must do anything, but the way he handles it is very like.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And I just don't think where he is in his life and the way he's feeling at the moment, he's right for her, because she needs, as Doug said, you know, she's needy, but also she's young, she's excited, she's got this kind of sparkle in her eye. She fell for Mark much deeper than he is for her, and she doesn't have the self-esteem, you know. That's why she did, because she's very much like, I want to do everything to please him, so I'm gonna put myself into the point where I'm in pain all day because that will make him happy. And he doesn't even acknowledge that at all. And so she kind of comes up and says, I'm really sorry, and your wife hates me, and you must be a really good dad, which again, I think hints at possibly her upbringing, in the fact that maybe she didn't have great parenting, or because she's like, oh, wow, you know, Rachel's so confident and you've done that. And then Mark hugs her, and I think there's a look of, I thought, worry in his eye. I think it's starting to drop the penny a bit here now. Maybe this isn't the right person at the right time. And he could do some real damage here. That's what I think.
Yeah.
That's my fear, is that the longer this goes on, the worse it's going to be when it ends. Because you know his heart's not in this.
Exactly. And he never was, really. It was easy. It must have been nice when you're feeling crap to have somebody who looks up to you the way she looks up to Mark. You know, she looks at him like he's just perfect. You know, everything he does is just amazing. And when you're feeling crap, who doesn't want to hear all that?
Yeah.
I feel bad as well for Cynthia in general, because nobody in the hospital respects her.
No.
So I'm referring to when, you know, there's a moment when she and Mark walk out of the room, everyone thinks that they've been having sex in the staff room.
Yeah.
And Carol, who we know doesn't like Cynthia, like she has, you know, I'm not saying not without reason, but she does not like Cynthia. So she makes a point of kind of going to see her in the bathroom and say, basically, will you just, you know, be a bit more discreet? And she's pleasant as much as possible about it. And Cynthia, in fairness to her, kind of pushes back and says, you know, what? I'm not saying, sorry, Cynthia was right, you know, but I'm just saying, you know, she does push back. And she does.
And I think that's good on her for pushing back. I think that's what you're talking about. Yeah.
And especially because when Cynthia walks in on Carol a bit later on in a delicate position, Carol, like, you would think, oh, this is going to be awkward now. Carol basically just shrugs.
Yeah. You know?
And I'm just like,
it's just her. Yeah, whatever.
Is I mean, I love Carol to the end of the day. I love Carol and Doug, but talk about double standards.
Well, yeah, because they actually have slept together, had a room that they would sleep together in the hospital.
Yeah.
And she's telling Cynthia that she's being, you know, what does she say? She's making people feel she's being inappropriate is what she says to her. Yes. And I'm like, hello. But I think as well, I mean, we'll get on to Carol, but I just think it just shows just how sweet and naive that little moment is when she says, but, you know, I was just trying to cheer up the three dwarves, Sleepy Doc and Happy, Grumpy, Sleepy Grumpy and Doc. And I just thought, oh gosh, look, she's so sweet. Isn't she so sweet?
And she's just like, she's wonderful. But Cynthia, get out of this relationship. Yeah. This is going to scar you.
Exactly. She needs somebody who won't take advantage, will listen to her and really appreciate when she does something for him and lifts her up rather than this kind of, oh, you're just there when I feel like messing around or whatever. You know, it's just, yeah. And Mark does not come off well in this relationship at all.
No, he does not.
And at the moment, I think in the hospital, as I say, I mean, what is he actually across? It feels like Weaver's kind of juggling balls on one side. And at one point, Anna ends up taking the Carter thing because it's so obvious that Green isn't doing anything, but just kind of like, I'll just send somebody at some point. It's like, what?
Well, I'll get a bail bondsman ready for the morning. Well, he's in prison now. And exactly. What if he gets shanked overnight?
Yeah,
exactly. Like, you know, it's Mark. Come on. Like, if Weaver had the capacity to even, you know, address this thing, she probably would have gone down herself.
Yeah, exactly. Or she would have
stood. $100,
yeah. She would have probably not allowed them to even take Carty. She would have been like, well, these are all the statutes and the reasons and all the, you know, possibly. Exactly. I can imagine her being quite, I'm sure there's a scene in the future where somebody gets arrested and one of the doctors gets arrested and she's quite aggressive with the policeman about the fact that he's being arrested, but you know, we'll get there. Where should we go next?
Should we go to Alan Jeanie, because it's another tough week for Jeanie.
Yes, yeah.
What did the writers have against poor Jeanie Bruce? Like, for the love of God.
Yes. I know. Oh.
Poor Jeanie, but poor Gloria Rubin. I really hope they had nice times on, like, off camera, because that woman was like in this sadness in every single episode. Sorry, I have strong feelings.
I am with you. I feel like the writers were totally, like, let's write for everybody here. But then we have this separate little bag of despair that anytime we're going to come up with something for Jeanie, we're going to put a hand in and pull something out. And it'll be like, you know, she gets hooked on drugs and then they decide to write that. And, you know, it is just misery piled on misery. And, you know, we've seen her get back with Al and it was working and it seemed really great. And then obviously, you know, that guy found out about Al and Al's got kind of blacklisted from everywhere and he now wants to move to Atlanta. But Jeanie, from the beginning, her heart hasn't been in that at all. And especially when she gets told she's being let go and she's not. I think for her, there's something, and she says it quite a few times, you know, that she's not going to run and that she doesn't want to hide. And I think for her, she's at county and she's been able to be honest about her illness and she's been able to forge a path and a career there without it being an issue. And I think that is really important to her. And we really see that driving this side of the story. This isn't just her going, I don't really love Al. This is a huge deal to me. And if I go to Atlanta, he's going to want to have to hide. So I'm not going to be able to be honest. And I don't, it's just not in her nature to live in that kind of way at all, is it? She's lying to him as well, because in the morning he kind of gets out. We see a bit of tension. She's like, you know, are you going to check the want ads? You know, you've got to look for jobs. And he's very, oh, this job in Atlanta will turn up. You know, it's happening. And he says, where are you going? She says, oh, I've got to go sign some papers. So she's not even being honest with him about, and that's where you know something's not right, that she can't even say to him, look, I want to try and get my job back because of this, this and this. She quietly goes to do it, doesn't she?
She's gone back to being Al's caregiver. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Of being the responsible one. She's not nagging him, but saying, have you checked the job pages? Practical. All you've done is look at the sports pages.
Have you been practical, you know?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, there's chicken in the fridge for lunch. Do you know what I mean? She's even saw out his lunch for him. It's just, nothing's changed, really. They've had a nice little rekindling, but it was all in the past, really.
It does feel that way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I think so. I think it suited what they needed when it happened.
Yes.
And, you know, they were able to lean on each other, which is, they absolutely needed that at the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, she is the grown-up, you know?
She is.
And he's, you know, he needs something else. He needs caring for, he needs, I don't know.
Somebody who's more practical and goes, because he's not, he's a dreamer and he's very, this job will come through. And she's very actually, you know, we need to plan for in case that doesn't happen. We can't just move to Atlanta and all of a sudden that job doesn't come through. And then I'm struggling to at a job that I'm hiding who I am. And I think a big reason why they got back together, and what I think is a positive from them being back together, was that they were maybe able to right a lot of wrongs that had happened in their marriage. You know, they were able to kind of get to a different point of understanding, and maybe this time when they part, it's a much better, healthier, happier terms, and they're not as broken by each other, maybe is kind of part of it. But I mean, Doyle has come through for her, and she's got her that hookup with the lawyers, and they meet in Doc Magoo's, and they talk to her about what happened and what she's been doing, and just ways forward. And so we see her, she's so determined, you know. Jeannie's just like, yeah, I'm going to do whatever it is. And they've got this action plan that they want her to follow, which I thought sounded fun. And then we see her, she comes in, she signs in, and Halea is like, what are you doing? And everybody's a bit like, oh, you're back. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to continue working. I'm not leaving. And I'm off to see patients, you know. And all the nurses and everybody are like, and Randy's like, great, here you go. Here's all these lacks that need to happen and things. and they're all kind of backing her, really. And it's quite sweet to see, because she, you know, that initial everything that when it came up and people were feeling uncomfortable seems to have gone, and people seem a lot more like, yeah, great, this, she's just Jeannie and everything's fine and we can manage this, and which you can really get why she'd want to stay, because it's not, you might not get that everywhere, and she's managed to get that and work for that and fight for that where she is.
Definitely.
Yeah,
I like the fact that he wants, you know, Al wants us to go to Atlanta, but she's actually being honest, fought for her job, fought for her respect. Yeah. And why would she go to Atlanta to start that all over again?
Exactly. And maybe not ever achieve it.
Yeah, exactly.
She might not even be allowed to tell people, because Al might be like, look, people will know this person at the hospital, finding out is married to that person. So they'll know it could implicate, you know, that I think is a big worry. And we see how she's working away, and we have this lovely moment with Toonie, because Toonie has no idea the fact that Jeannie's back, you know, illegally in some way.
Yeah.
And she says to Carrie, oh, it's so nice Jeannie's back. I'm glad you changed your mind. And could you see the smoke coming out of Weaver's ears?
Oh, my. So this is obviously, it's a tough storyline, because not only Weaver is being made to be the villain.
Yes.
As opposed to, like, she did fire Jeannie for budgetary reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did. Like, we know this. And in a way, I'm totally behind Jeannie. She's absolutely right to fight it. I just wish it wasn't at the expense of their friendship.
Yeah.
It very much is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you come back from that? That's somebody who has turned around and gone, not only do I think you're lying, but I'm going to take away your authority at work and make you look silly in front of all your colleagues and make Anspar, you know, walk it back. But it's very much like Jen and Green here, though. Again, it's like Jen is Weaver and Green is Anspar, and Anspar's like, what's the easiest way out? How do I have the least to do? And actually, it doesn't really impact him. It impacts Weaver, doesn't it? Because Weaver's the one who has to be the one the face of it and the one who whose authority is gone. And because she, at the beginning, the first scene with Weaver, we see she's with Anspar and he says, oh, you know, have you heard anything about Jeannie? And she says, oh, no, she went quietly, it's all great. And he's like, you handled it really well. So, you know, she's feeling good about that. And for Jeannie to kind of come back. And I think as well for Weaver, she really did fight for her, didn't she, when she was sick. And it must feel a bit like a slap in the face. And like, I did all that. You know, it's not about that because I was backing you and now you're using that. But I also see from Jeannie's point of view, she might believe that actually underneath all Weaver, that might be a factor, because it did just all of a sudden come out after that moment where she'd had her hands in the guy, as we'd said, and kind of comes out. But she says to her, you know, you can't treat patients, makes her leave. And then and she starts logging it. That's what I thought was really funny. It's okay, I'm gonna log it, you know. And I just thought, oh gosh, you know, this is just obviously she's building her case. And we have that moment where they're having this kind of heated argument and the phone goes and they say, oh, it's Aunt Spar, and Weaver's like, finally. And the person's like, oh no, for Jeannie. And it's like, oh, you know, again, she's got the upper hand here over Weaver. Weaver's not the one who's being consulted.
Well, Kerry was calling security to have her removed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like,
patience is just running out much at this point.
But I guess what else could she do? You know, she's been trying to call Aunt Spar all morning and Aunt Spar's been in some meeting. And like, what do you do when in front of everybody, she is, you're saying to her, you're not allowed to work, and she's making notes and, you know, just your authority's been chopped down, you know. I see why Weaver got pushed. I don't particularly agree with it, but I can understand.
Yeah.
Let me see how strongly she feels, because
just to agree with you. Like, you know, she's been put in a horrible situation. And then for Anspar, again, understandable. Yes, legal point of view, delighted Jeannie got her job back. But for Anspar to go like, yeah, listen, just undo all that, would you?
Exactly. And all the heartache and all that stress. And I think as well, she even says to him, she says, you know, this is blackmail. That's how deeply she feels about it. It was nothing but budget, and we're just giving the wrong message and all that stuff. And normally Kerry's quite practical, so for her to really go out on a limb and not really care about the legal implications, I think shows how deeply she feels about it.
I totally agree. I think she sees Jeannie using her HIV status as a bargaining chip. Well, obviously, that is the way she sees, because she didn't fire her for that reason. So I think as well, she's got this, I supported you when your diagnosis was revealed. I helped you hide it. I then went out on a limb for you when Mark wasn't sure how to act, when Anspar wasn't sure how to act. And as you said earlier, I fought really hard. I actually put in a really good word for you. You mentioned Al Atlanta. I spoke to somebody in Atlanta. And then what she sees is someone going, I don't like this. So, HIV, that's why they fired me. And it's funny because she is the one who did the firing, but the betrayal Weaver must feel during all this as well, justified or no, the betrayal that she must feel. And there is one moment in this episode where it is both shoehorned in, and yet it actually fits the theme perfectly, is there is this ongoing discussion with another patient of, you know, what is chronic pain? And she, you know, she says, people deal with it. She's lost her rag at this point. She's like, absolutely not. People deal with pain. They suck it up and they deal with it. And then the moment I mean is when it's her very last shot. She's just walking and she has to sit down. And we almost never see Weaver acknowledge the fact that she has, you know, a physical disability to the point where she needs a crutch to move around. And she sits down and she's worn out. And I think it's everything. It's everything is just sitting on her so much. And she's just like, I need a break.
Yeah.
And because she's so always... you know, she is the last person to be like, I'm in pain, or I feel a bit weak today, or I'm not up to it. She's the first one to push everything back and just take everything, try to be, because you almost forget she has that, because she never discusses it. She never says, oh, these are my needs because of, otherwise I get in pain. It's just, she just continues as she is. And, you know, that might be detrimental for her health in the long run, but that's just how she is. So yeah, I thought that was a really interesting addition. And I want to come back and talk a bit more about the pain and the chronic pain in Mr. Jackson's case, because I have a lot of thoughts. Well, we have this kind of bittersweet, well, a couple of bittersweet moments, because Al runs up to Jeannie, who's on the street, and Jeannie's so excited. She says, Al, I've got my job back. I've done it. I got my job. And he's like, oh, but we're moving. I've got my job. And that's where they start these really tough discussions. And she says, I don't want to run. And I worked hard and this. And he's like, yeah, but if I stay, I can't do my job. And I'm blacklisted. And then later Jeannie comes home and Al's clothes are gone and he's not there. And she's obviously very worried that he's left, but he hasn't left. He's still there. He'd gone to get petrol. And then they have this kind of breakup scene, don't they, where they don't say it, but it's just inevitable and they both know it, you know.
Yeah.
Which I thought was sweet and sad.
I'm glad it wasn't a fight. Yes. You know, we've seen also, like, for the love of God, give that poor woman a break. But, you know, we've seen them go through so much, and that there is just we both know what the answer is here, isn't it? You're going to Atlanta. I'm staying in Chicago. There was one thing as well, and this shows how much Al, for him personally, he has to get out of there. He has to leave Chicago. The job, it's a good job, but it's only 6 months.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a forever job. You know, exactly. I suppose that is the nature, the nature of construction jobs. Like, you are on a project, you know, finish that project and you move on to the next one. So, like, they could have said, let's see where we are in 6 months, but they don't.
They both know it's not going to happen. I know what you mean. I don't think either of them are fooling themselves with this.
No.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's all left. They don't need to say it, do they? They don't need to say breakup. I think it's just, you're going, I'm staying. We had a great time. I love you. We'll always be in each other's lives.
Yeah.
Is the other implication I got. And then she kind of watches him, because, I mean, there's that moment where she says, you know, you've always been able to make me laugh since we were teenagers, and you realize their history and that support system. And then he leaves and she watches out the window, and it's just so heartbreaking. And it's, oh, that woman. Somebody give Jeannie Boulay a hug. And
an Emmy. She deserves something. Like,
yeah.
Like, that poor woman.
Yeah.
Gloria Rubin, I know you're listening. So I hope you had a lovely time. As I say, I hope everyone was really, really nice to you when the camera stopped rolling, because everyone's just so bloody horrible.
Yes, that's so horrible. I hate it. Let's go with Weaver for a bit, because she's got some interesting things happening. The guy from Ellis West from Synergix, which I think I mentioned before, sounds like an evil corporation from one of the Spider-Mans or Superman or something, you know.
Like Cyberdyne.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
If comic books have taught us anything, do not get into bed with somebody from Synergix or Synergix. There's Green Goblins and all types of bad people. Is how I feel. But, you know, Ellis West comes in, he's setting up all the tech and the computer stuff, and he's showing Weaver, you know, oh, look at this really funky dictation system, which you'll dictate it.
Oh, my God, the 90s.
Clunky. The 90s. I know. It's like, you strap this in here, and you do that, and then you put the thing, and then there's a microphone round
it's
here.
It's portable, even though it's the size of Germany.
You would put your 700-pound backpack on. That's the battery. Yeah. It lasts 5 minutes.
No wonder she's got hip pain at the end. He's stressed her out with all this tech weighing her down. Oh. And then it puts it all on a floppy. I'm like, oh, my Lord.
Oh, my God.
Could you, oh, floppy disk.
Kids, a floppy disk was what, you know the way you've got the save button on your computer? Well, we used to have physical ones of them.
And that's why that's that symbol. History lesson. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. So, you know, we've got Ellis West on one side, and then we've got Weaver fighting with Jeannie and not getting any backup from Anspar.
Yeah.
But then he does offer her, and this is the thing as well about Ellis West, is he's just too good to be true. He offers her this, come to St. Bart's with me. You can just do a little talk, but really, you know, we'll fly first class and we'll be put up in these amazing hotels. I mean, it sounds amazing. You know, he's saying all the right things and he has all the right things, which is why I do not trust him.
Oh, God.
No. Yeah. And the fact he says, I'll be at the Ritz-Carlton, is to say, oh, we're going to have another, you know, steam session in my hotel room.
Exactly. It's so presumptuous, but also, you know, he's very much courting her.
Oh, absolutely. Fine, oh, my God, absolutely.
Do you think it's because he actually is interested in her, or do you think it's a mix of interest and, oh, this is a way to keep her on side? I don't know. Yeah, I can't separate. Maybe.
I think maybe, instead of him being, like, out and out, like, I mean, he is the voice of Lex Luthor from the Superman animated graphic, so he is evil. There's no question. But maybe. I think there is an attraction there. I think it's more of a, you know, as you say, keep her on side, but you can do that with professional gifts.
That's yes.
You know, she might not take them, though.
Because I haven't watched ahead, I really hope she takes that trip to St. Bart's. I'll be honest, she's earned it.
She used to take Jeannie with her. Jeannie's earned it, if anybody's earned it.
It's true. Just, well, Jeannie can't. She has to work.
She does.
Get over their tension, just
take them two together.
Yeah.
Don't wear Ellis West and they can just
have a little affair. What happens at St. Bart's? Yeah. Come back and it's all sorted.
I am on board with every moment of this. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so Mr. Jackson comes in. Mr. Jackson is suffering from, he's having a crisis. He suffers from sickle cell and he's having a crisis. And he knows exactly his pain and what works and what doesn't. He's very used to, it seems, used to the medical profession and how he has to talk to them and the hoops he has to jump through and things that they expect. And it's tough because he suffers with a lot of pain, and what deals with pain is obviously painkillers, but a lot of painkillers are also things that are quite addictive. So you get a lot of people, you know, who are addicted to it, possibly lying to get the drugs, and how do you differentiate it? It's tough. But he comes in, he says, right, this is what I need. It's 200 of Demerol, nothing else is going to touch in. And Weaver's very, no. I'm the doctor here. You're just a drug seeker, is where she seems to come to.
I think not as harsh, but she's kind of taken the approach that Mark took with the lady who he assumed was on crack.
Yeah.
And, you know, therefore missed a diagnosis of a pregnancy. Now, it's not quite as harsh as that initially. You know, she's like, okay, let's do the liter of saline and let's, you know, we'll go through the motions. We have to go through the motions. But she's absolutely like, you know, kind of right. Okay, we have to give him some Demerol. And I will cut her a bit of slack here, because how many... I feel terrible for the poor gentleman who's in this bad situation, but he is presenting as, you know, kind of like, everyone give me Demerol, give me 250. I think maybe the fact that he's so specific about the dosage is a hint that actually, no, he's not a pusher. He's not a user.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, he could be like, give me all the Demerol you could possibly get into me.
Yeah.
Would be a bit more like, really? But like, no, I need 250 of Demerol.
I think there's a few things that are a bit at play here, which I think is tough. So I think Weaver has her own pain lens. So in her brain, I survive, therefore other people should just survive. You know, it's not like this person's in pain and nobody else in the world is. There's also the fact that he is African-American, and there is this belief in the medical community, which is ingrained, unfortunately, that African-American people are stronger and don't feel pain the same way and can deal with a lot more. That's why there's high mortality rates and things. And also, I think sickle cell isn't as understood because, again, it predominantly affects people of color, people from Africa, people from kind of South America, India, you know. And I think that also plays into all of this. And I felt a lot of pain watching it because I'm somebody who has a pain condition, and I've been in this world where you are trying to explain that, A, you have a lived experience and you know and you have knowledge. Okay, you're not a doctor, but you know your body, you know yourself. Yeah. And there are just some hoops that it's just so tiring to have to jump through because you've done it and you know this is what it is you need. And I also think that there needs to be a real look at pain and painkillers in the medical community, because we know that, you know, there's a sense that, oh, addiction is bad, addiction is bad, but some people can't live or survive or live well without some form of pain medication. So it as much as we need to start weighing things up and not just being like, you can't have these tablets anymore, even though they're helping you live and survive and stuff, just because some people get addicted, or, and maybe that person is addicted, but also it doesn't mean that they're not in pain. And so those are all the things for me that I struggled with watching this bit. And I really felt for this guy, because I've been there with somebody who just doesn't want to listen and just thinks that they know better. And pain is so subjective. So as much as Kerry's walking around thinking I'm in pain, you don't know that what your pain is to him and what his is, you know.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing to sort of be like, oh, some people have pain. Like, yeah, they're doing it. It's debilitating and he can't function, clearly.
Yeah.
I love, because obviously Doug will tie into this story, because the patient, she streets him, as Weaver, she says herself, you know, give him a little bit of this and then street him, get rid of him, you know. And so he does, he comes back because he's in so much pain. Now, Doug, who has a fresh set of eyes, he's only just, because there's a joke where, you know, his car broke down and took him ages, he's late for a shift, which means he misses an awful lot of the nonsense of the day, if you like. So he's rested, fresh set of eyes, and he's brilliant with his patient, because he's just like, listen, he says I'm going to trust you here, but we're going to do this my way. I'm going to help you through this pain. And he does, he's fantastic. And it turns out that, yes, I mean, there was the question of, is he just seeking Demerol? No, he wasn't. He really was in pain. Doug had / took the time to listen to him, worked through something with him. And Weaver, because what she observes is another doctor undermining her. Now, it's not what has happened, but that's what she observes happening, as she's right over and she is bullying, because of course she's just had ANSPA pull the rug out from under her when it comes to Jeannie. So she's just had one bit of her authority stripped from her.
Yeah.
And then, hang on, now you've got Doug, with whom she's butted heads several times, and he's looking after my patient. And she's straight over, and this is when we get the line of, people just, they're in pain, you suck it up and you deal with it. And you see Caroline Duggar just like, that's, has anyone explained what being a doctor means to her?
Yeah, it's such a, and I think a big key part of this whole Mr. Jack's storyline is Carol, because Carol believes him, and Carol did not agree with the way Weaver treated him at all. And she purposely gets Doug to come and look at him, because she knows that Doug will listen and will care and will have a better approach. And Doug also actually listens. We didn't hear before, because Weaver didn't take a second, but it turns out his medication was stolen. That's why he doesn't have it. Normally it's really well controlled because he has his medication, but it was taken. And Weaver didn't take 2 seconds to find that out from him and to try and get any kind of backstory or history. But we see Doug being brilliant with him, and, you know, as you say, Weaver sees him as low-hanging fruit. She can't say anything to Anspa, she can't do anything about Jeannie, but she can do something about Doug. So he gets her wrath. And yeah, I just, it's a tough storyline for me to watch, because I have a lot of personal things going on with it too. And I believed him. I really thought, and actually Doug was just Doug at his best. You know, this is what we love, when he's like this, when he's just, you know,
season 4 Doug is like peak Doug.
Yeah, yes. He just gets to him and he says, like, you know, he just calms him down and talks to him like he's a person, which I think is so important. Weaver talked to him like he was an addict. And I'm sure, as somebody who has got a pain illness and has had to deal with a lot of medical people, but also as somebody who's Black, to be called, you know, being treated like an addict must just bring stuff up in him. So good on Doug. I get it, Weaver. There are things I do feel bad for you about, but I didn't like this. I'm just going to put that out.
An ugly look on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think, I thought she was taking a Jeannie angst out on him. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, 100%.
She's felt powerless. And then another place she's been, had a power and her authority checked.
Exactly.
Or rather challenged, is by Doug. Well, he wasn't challenging her at all.
No, he didn't even know she treated him.
I know, exactly. But did you see Halle's look at Kerry when she found out that Jeannie had got her own way, there's a proper look from Halle of,
It's because it's just over her shoulder, isn't it? Yeah, She's almost out of focus.
Yeah.
It's good because we've not really had a lot of Halle this season.
No. Halle and Randy. Lydia.
Randy's in this episode for like a second.
And I was like, come back. I miss you, Randy.
She's been set up her empire.
That's true. And I think also it's probably because Cynthia's there and they need to give her the storylines, don't they? So it's kind of, Randy's kind of
That makes sense.
Jerry's gone and Randy's in the background. That's my understanding, but
Jerry's using his personal time.
Down in Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Right, so should we do Benton and...
Benton, I really like this day.
Brilliant moment.
Really like this one. Because we get... Benton has changed since becoming a dad. All right, and it has been good because initially it looks like we're just having Benton butting heads again, and it turns out not to be that at all, and we get kind of some peak Benton in this episode.
We really do. We love it. So we have this mother and daughter who come in, and they are both obviously very badly injured, and the daughter is obviously really worried about her mom and is quite stressed, but also not focused on herself at all, even though she might lose a limb, and they are discussing that in front of her, and she's not, I don't know, she doesn't seem to react to that. She's so busy kind of thinking about her mom. And Corday says to Benton, can I take this one? Because I think I might be able to help save her leg. And Benton's like, fine, and kind of goes to deal with the mom, and the mom passes, unfortunately. And then they're upstairs and they're in surgery, and Corday's talking about how she thinks she could save the leg, and it's all part of this kind of cutting edge surgery that she's doing. I don't know what they call it, you know, she's kind of studying up on it, or she's trying to do some practice cases and things like that. And Benton's really worried because it doesn't feel like, you know, she's been down long, the blood hasn't been flowing for long enough. He doesn't think it's viable to put her under anesthetic and actually do this thing.
I was wondering if when just initially, just in the early few seconds of this surgery, if he was kind of going, there's a whiff of Count V around this. It's like, are you just doing for the glory? You know, like this, you know, looking at the medically. Yes, looking at the medically side of this.
Yes, that's English.
Is this wise? Then, so on the flip, you have Romano who... it's kind of an extended cameo really in this episode, but Romano is kind of he's so emotionally detached from anything he does. Like, he's just like, okay, we will do the thing, and if the thing works, great, you know, and we'll write papers and we'll all be great, and if it doesn't work, okay, you know, it's a statistic. And you know, you're kind of wondering like, oh, is there a bit of that in Corday as well? Mm-hmm. And we see for the first time in season 4, no mistakes have been made, but we see Corday kind of lose it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it adds a depth to her character that we all know she has, but it adds a depth to her character that we had not yet seen.
Yeah, because she's been quite flawless, hasn't she? She's kind of come in, been a real whiz kid, being able to just kind of, anything she touches kind of turns to gold. I also really love it when Benton's arguing with her and she just says, don't be so dramatic. She's a young woman who deserved to keep her leg. And I just thought, I loved that. And actually, I was thinking, if I was, you know, that poor patient, I would like them to try everything they could to save my leg if possible.
Yeah.
You know, so I think so. Obviously, you know, they go through the surgery and things aren't going well, and there are moments it doesn't look good. And later, she's kind of sitting by the daughter after the patient. I call her the daughter because she was the daughter of the woman who passed. Well, she's kind of watching over her, isn't she? And this is where Benton comes over and he brings her English breakfast tea because she's English and that's all we drink. I thought it was really sweet.
Like, oh, how lovely, thank you.
Thoughtful, you know, that he'd gone, oh, she's English, she might like English tea.
I mean, the logic checks out.
Why not? I thought it was sweet, but it also made me laugh a lot. But that is all we drink in England. And
of course, And he's so lovely. He's so lovely to her.
So sweet. Yeah. He's not like, oh, I told you so. Oh, you should have done this. Yeah. He just...
Earlier Benton would have been like, I told you this was not a good idea. And at no point does he do that, which is great.
And then they have this...
Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah. No, you...
I think I was saying the same thing. They open up about this, the conflict between ambition and treatment, and Corday opens up and says there might have been a bit of that.
Yeah.
But I think if it was, she wouldn't feel so bad and she wouldn't be sat by a bedside.
Exactly that. I think, but I thought, yeah, that was so fascinating because that is something I think they come up a lot. That must be something that really... It is a real challenge every day for them, you know, when they come across a case. Are they trying to do this crazy surgery because they think it's best for the patient, or are they because they can go, I did the crazy surgery, you know? And I loved this discussion because I think of all the surgeons we've met, these two are the most thoughtful, aren't they? And the most, Bar Carter, who was also when he was a surgeon, was very, very thoughtful and very, you know, these two are really like philosophical and take their time and, to me, just seem like we'll be all the better surgeons for that.
What I really like as well is that through Benton and Corday now, more so, I feel more so through Benton and Corday than we got with Benton and Carter.
Mm.
You see that what goes on in the OR is a totally different level of medicine.
Yeah.
It's neither better nor worse. It's just a totally different level. And the considerations are different. Generally there's less running around and shouting and screaming because generally, you know, you're kind of like you book in for the OR, but obviously there's a bit of that in this. And you see Corday, she gets such a fright because things do look like they're going to go south really quickly. And, you know, Romano even shouts at her and, you know, it looks bad. It looks bad. And it's such a peek behind the curtain of in the OR, you tend to, I think I'm going to phrase it this way. In the OR, you tend to do it by the book. Now, you might be writing the book as you go along, but it's quite A to B to C to D. Whereas in the ER, of course, you're sitting there with super glue, staples and hope a lot of the time just to get you through the next few seconds,
That is such a great name for a memoir of an ER doctor, can I say? Super glue, staples and hope.
Oh,
Sean said on this day, copyright.
That's it. And I think this is what's great about the addition of Corday, because before that we had kind of bits of ER, bits of OR, but it feels like now they're making an actual concerted effort to go, no, we're going to actually create things around Benton and create the actual OR so that we can talk about surgery, because as the show goes on, surgery becomes in its own right. They always have a surgical character and there are always surgical storylines, whereas before it felt very much like Benton would come in and mostly it was stuff down here and all with him and Carter up there, but not in the same way, because Corday is somebody that Benton respects and is on his level, so he's going to take the time to have these conversations that he probably wouldn't have had with Carter. And so we're getting this other side, this more thoughtful, this more rounded side. And I really like that we get these kinds of doctors who think and talk about it rather than this is Edson and Romano and they just cut and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
We obviously they're there too, but they're not the focal. They're just kind of, yeah, you'll get this. This is run of the mill, but we've also kind of got these guys, which it's just such a sweet moment, a real nice moment of building kind of their friendship and their respect for each other, and shows us how far Benton has gone and grown, which is a lot, I think.
Yeah, I do like that Corday said, "There's the rub," which is a line from Hamlet, just to cement her angle.
Is that from Hamlet?
Yeah.
Aye, there's the rub.
Sleep. I'd had the quote.
The chance to dream.
That's it. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Now. Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm going to go and light my two English degrees on fire. I didn't know that.
Sleep, perchance a dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come.
I knew every bit of it but the rub. I will say that. I knew the perchance to dream.
It's interesting you didn't know about rubbing. But,
Oh, my
goodness.
Just to finish, I like Benton and Corday this week.
Yes.
I was just going to say. forever. Should we go to Doug and Carol? Because they just made me so happy this week. They were so cute. You know, we see Carol kind of in the opening where Trudy's like, oh, I thought Doug was supposed to be in. And she says, oh, he called, he's late. And Trudy doesn't even look, but all of a sudden Carol catches herself. And says, I mean, he called the hospital, which I thought was a bit more obvious than if she just said he called. Because I didn't insinuate that he'd called her. But, you know, when you're guilty, you see things that others don't. And then when he walks in, it just felt like, I personally was like, oh,
yeah,
he's here. Yeah. Everything's good. He's back.
The hospital just got 50% more handsome.
Oh, yeah.
Carol bounces along to him.
Hello, shake hands. Keep a distance. Hello, doctor.
Pleasure to meet you, sir.
Who are you?
You
know, they're really trying to, obviously, they're still hiding it, but they're so happy to see each other. And Green knows this. And this is where Green is so sweet in this episode, because he takes Doug aside and says, look, you've got this patient you have to go see. You know, only you're the only one who can help. And he's a bit like, oh gosh, I've got to help this patient who's like got depression and all this stuff. And he kind of opens the door, and it's Carol, and I thought that made me really smile. So cute when they're in that room. They just kiss. And did you see Carol grabbing his bum as well?
Yes, I did.
Of course you did. Yeah.
Of course I did. It's like, you know, excuse me, Carol. I think you'll find that my name is written on that. No. it was just so lovely. And because there was just that moment at the desk where he's, you know, he plays it cool. Hi, Carol. Nice to see you again. He kind of walks off, and she looks so kind of, I don't like that. I want to hug and kiss and be, you know, open, but also we can't be. So then they just fall into each other's arms and onto each other's lips. And then the door opens.
Yes.
Cynthia. Yes. Dun, dun, dun. And this could have been such a moment for Cynthia. Again, this, I think, shows how sweet she is, because she doesn't immediately think, I'm going to go up to Carol later and say, well, now who's being inappropriate? Hypocrite. You know, she could have screamed hypocrite at her very loud and pointed, but she didn't do any of that. She just kind of shut the door and walked away. And as we say, Carol didn't seem perturbed, but maybe you're not, if you've got, you know, Doug in your arms.
It's just a kind of like, Cynthia, you're not even registering at this point. Sorry, but you know, we'll probably continue even if you're in the room, to be honest.
You're not going to slow us down. I just thought it was a really, you know, there's not lots of Doug and Carol this week, but it was enough. It was just like this perfect little swirling in the middle of this episode, which I thought was just, I don't know, my heart was soaring. I was like, this is peak them. They're just so beautiful together. And, you know, after everything that they've been going through recently, and seeing them come back together was gorgeous. And I loved it.
It was gorgeous every second.
Oh, yes, baby. Yes. Love
them to all. Now to talk about another darling. Let's talk about Carter.
I was about to say, another beautiful couple, or the couple that he treats, but...
Well, I think it's really funny. So the first thing we see of Carter is he's asking Randy and Anna for money. He's asking them for money so he can use the vending machine. And Randy just says no and walks off like as only Randy could in this kind of way. Are you kidding me? And Anna gives him money. He tries to give the change back, but she also makes a little quip about, you know, like the Kennedys don't carry cash. And I was thinking, and like the Queen and stuff, they don't carry cash, do they? Just shows how rich he is. He's only got cards. Right.
That's it. Sorry, guys. If anyone was thinking about mugging the Queen, you actually won't get anything out of it. You know, she doesn't carry cash. And actually, moving swiftly along from that joke, we get to meet a character who is going to become quite the storyline.
Yes.
And that is Chase Carter.
Yes.
So, yes.
Carter's cousin is here.
It's a heavy one, isn't it?
Yes.
It is, but it starts
happy-go-lucky, you know, handsome, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, kind of, we're all just mucking about. He says at one point, I'm a photographer. But apparently a spider with the biggest fangs in the world latched onto his arm.
It's America, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't get spiders like that over here.
Thank God. This is why I can't live elsewhere. It scares me. Spiders that big would just, the idea of having a bite like that, I can't deal with it. I've seen arachnophobia from a very young age. That's all I can see and hear that music. So we meet Chase, and again, it's doing that really brilliant thing of colouring in a part of Carter's life that we wouldn't ordinarily know about, you know. And and he's so funny, you know, we get this sense he's very much like, oh yeah, yeah. And they talk about all the different cousins, because somebody, you know, basically it turns out Carter's the favorite to take over the foundation. It seems to be the favorite. Currently Chase works at the foundation, but obviously not well because he's not rated. And he's very much, I don't know, he didn't seem resentful. He seemed quite like, oh yeah, you know how kind our lives are. Yeah.
You know, yeah, like he's the playboy that our Carter, John, isn't.
Exactly. Like, yes, exactly. He's very much, oh, I was away at Thanksgiving and I don't really bother about this stuff and I go and have fun and I live for pleasure. He just is very, he's very what you expect a rich person, I think, to be.
A little bit. And he's, in this episode, he's quite likable.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't seem to be like, yes, he is kind of flash of the cash a little bit, but he's not, you know, oh, everyone around me is poverty. They're all lower than me. No. It's not that. He's just like, oh, well, we'll all go and have a party then, you know?
Yeah.
And to which he invites Anna to the house. Oh, you come, we'll have a party.
I also really loved it when he said, come, let's go for lunch. And Carter's like, no, I've got it. I'm working. And he says, oh, just blow it off. And I just thought that is so brilliant insight into what he just doesn't get, you know, day-to-day job. But this is also clicking as to why he's probably not good at the foundation, because he just doesn't actually go in. Maybe he just leaves early all the time. And
If you were to ask him, like, so James, what does the foundation do? He'd be like, everyone's having a good time.
Yeah, I'm going to party. And then we get this bit where Carter says to Anna, oh, everybody just thinks that might be me being a doctor is like a phase. And we get that sense from all of them, like he says, you know, he's got his photography and other people have got their things. But there's this sense that Grandpa will expect everybody to come back home to roost at one point, he says, you know. I just love the way that they think that John's being a doctor is so beneath them, but also... Yeah. Just like a little hobby, as if like, oh yeah, I'm just going to be a doctor for a minute or two. You know, it's just so, I just thought that was such an insight into this world.
Complete separation of reality. It's like, for obviously with several exceptions, being a doctor is one of the longest training periods.
Yeah.
Like Carter's been an intern for about 7 years now, you know? Like, this is not something you do over the summer.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. You don't. Yeah, I'm just going to intern at a hospital for a minute and then I'll be back. You know, this is his life. And we also get to see how different he is from them, I guess, you know, this, because he does understand responsibility and he does seem to go, right, I really wanted to be a doctor. I didn't even have to be. This is what I just really wanted it. And then this is where the couple comes in, the couple that I call them the domestic violence couple, because they come in and there's kind of allegations of domestic violence. She says that he was trying to hurt her. He says she was trying to kill him. There's a policeman also who's come in with them. And so Carter and Anna have to go and help this case. And I thought that this was a really tough one in the sense that knowing who was saying what was true, but also I thought the power dynamics, because it turns out that the husband is actually also a cop. So this other cop and the husband, you know, the wife at one point says, you know, they are in it together and I can't go to the police about him because he is the police and they're all his friends. And I thought it highlighted that part of kind of domestic violence, because that is horrible, you know. We hear a lot about policemen hurting their wives and then nothing being done because they have friends and they can make stuff go away. But yeah, I mean, she does appear quite drunk. So also you're a bit like, oh gosh, what did happen here?
Yeah, like it's kind of, nothing is really cut and dry. And so when you have that police officer, it's like he demands a talk screen, basically. And Carter, I think initially he's just rubbing Carter up the wrong way. Like, of course.
Don't uncuff her. He's like, that's a problem. Yeah.
I actually thought for a second, now it turns out this wasn't the case, but I thought he had cuffed her so tightly that it had cut into her wrist, because when they removed the cuffs, you find there is a wound on her wrist. And now but they do go, did you try and kill yourself? And she's like, she says, no, it was an accident, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, grand. So it's kind of like, you know, immediately it's like, cop, excuse me. But anyway, it wasn't him.
Yeah.
But It was funny initially, because he demands a talk screen and Carter's like, get out the ER. But of course, you would imagine during the normal things, of course, Carter will do a talk screen. Like, of course you will, you know? It'll just be like, but also, like, you're looking at it going, like, it's not a case of how, or it's not a case of if, it's a case of how much.
Yes.
You know, and later on it's revealed that it's like, I'm dreadful when it comes to understanding what the numbers mean. Blood alcohol, it's high.
It was high.
Yeah, it's, you know, she's like, when you look at her and go, she's hammered, basically the blood screen came back and said, yep, she's hammered.
Yeah, that's all it said, hammered.
Yeah, that's it. It's only in degrees. It's like, you know, kind of okay to drive or hammered. That's the two.
And she was hammered right at the top. And I think that's what is interesting about this case, because it's so murky, because just because she was, you know, did drink doesn't mean that she wasn't also a victim of domestic violence. And it doesn't mean that also she couldn't have also been the one to try and kill him. You know, this is it's about accepting that multiple things can be true and there is no perfect victim. And I think what really gets to Carter is he walks in, doesn't he, him and Anna walk in on the cop and the husband chatting about how they're gonna jail her and throw away the key. So I think that's what Carter feels, very much that this is a biased case, and he doesn't want to be feeding into that.
Good job Doyle wasn't on this case, because she'd have known them all and said, oh yeah, that's what she, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
she would. It's good job it's Anna.
Exactly, yeah. If Doyle was there, it's like, all right Doyle, could you intubate this? What, Doyle, why are you stabbing her in the throat? Stop this. This the cops looking after cops. Bloody hell.
Yeah,
you're a doctor. That's not what we do here.
Yeah. So, you know, like, Doyle, really? Would you go and be a cop? I mean, I think you'd be happier as a cop.
I think she'd be happier as a cop. She could kill as many people as she wanted without any trouble. And I think that's what it is, isn't it? It's that moment where you kind of realise whatever is going on, this policeman isn't right, and he's not actually after justice. He's trying to screw this woman, basically, rightly or wrongly. That's not how it should be done. So Carter's very much like, no, you know, leave, go get a warrant, which he does. He comes back and Carter's very set. I mean, at one point he's like, well, they've got the stomach contents, don't they? And he goes to pour it out, and the cop says, no, you can't do that. It's destroying evidence. He says, well, that warrant doesn't say that about stomach contents, does it? It doesn't cover that. So he throws it out, and then he gets arrested. That's when he gets arrested.
Yeah.
And I just thought the way he was arrested was, because the whole time he's like, you can't do this. But the guy still manages to do it and take him. And then this little train follows them. Everybody kind of gets on this train and follows them outside and watches him kind of get put in the back of the car. And they're all helpless. They're all a bit like, what do we do?
Everyone's like, you know, kind of, this surely can't be real. This is not really happening, is it?
Yeah.
And even Carter's a bit like, you know, and I like this swagger about him, I have to say.
Yeah.
It'll be sorted. Like, it's fine.
He wouldn't do this, but you can just imagine him going like, I'll be here by lunchtime. I'll have Dad make a couple of calls. He almost says something. But it gets pretty real when he's standing there getting his mugshot taken. He's like, hang on. I'm in jail.
Yeah. This is real. And this is going to go on. This is becoming official. You know, they take his fingerprints. They take his picture. They tell him not to smile because he's trying to smile, which I thought was so cute. And then he gets put behind bars, and he's very much like my family, with old family friends with the commissioner, you know. He's
Superintendent Rodriguez. I'll get my father to call him.
Yeah. And no, he's not allowed to do any of that.
I love so much. He's sitting there in the cell with, you know, everyone else has just been brought in. And someone goes, Mr. Carter. And he walks up and says, Dr. Carter. And the guy's just like, well, excuse the hell me.
Yeah. And he's no, it was for accuracy.
Yeah.
It was a Carter, big pissy.
That's a Carter, shut up. You're out of your element here.
Yeah, just be quiet. Sit quietly there.
There is a comedy film out of this. Do you know what I mean? Where
absolutely.
A doctor, then he ends up diagnosing everybody and treating people, and he's carried out on everybody's shoulders, and there's a cop in the doorway going, why I order, and shaking his fist at him.
Exactly. Yeah, because Shrek is the name. The guy, you know, he's quite intimidating. He's sitting across Shrek, from him. And, he's very much like, what are you, you know, and Carter's trying to be nice and make small talk. What are you in for? And he says, obstruction of justice. He's like, oh, me too. And then, like, oh my God, we're the same. You know, it's like, And then Shrek gets up and walks towards him because he's like, you're a doctor. And he walks towards him and Carter starts panicking, thinking something's going to happen. He says, I've got something for you in here. And Carter's like, oh my God. And it turns out it is just that he wants a diagnosis on his, whatever he's got, some bump or lump or carbuncle. Something down there.
Carbuncle,
which sounds crazy to
me. I think it's just like a skin infection thing, isn't it?
Oh, okay. I think it's, do you know what my crazy head always says? Because I've heard carbuncle a few times, but my head always substitutes the word barnacle.
Yes.
And I'm just like, so you've got a clasping shellfish stuck to your leg, or what? Bottom feeder. I've gone out of my head.
What it is to me, because carbuncle, to me, it's just too much of a fun sounding word. Like, it sounds very cartoony. Like,
do you want to know? I've had a quick Google.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
A carbuncle is cluster of boils.
Oh.
And then there's this is from Mayo Clinic. And there's a little hyphen a bit. Painful, pus-filled bumps.
Oh, no.
That form a connected area of infection under the skin. A boil is a painful, pus-filled bump that forms under your skin when bacteria infect and inflame one or more of your hair follicles.
This is hideous. Well, that's what he has, and Carter's trying to treat him, but he's also trying to get away just as he gets saved, basically. Well, again, the cash comes up because the guy says, if you can give me £100, you can go now. And he's like, oh, I've got my credit card. And they're like, no, it has to be cash. And this is where Anna's basically come in and say, because she keeps going to Green, what's happening? Green's like, better stuff. I'm going to send a bail bondsman on a horse and across the desert, he's going to send, God, what's the maternity lady called? He's going to send her to get the bail and he'll...
Oh, I might say Romano. What's her name?
Her name.
Coburn.
Coburn. He's going to say Coburn.
He'll be there till Christmas.
And Anna just basically goes, give the number to me. I'll deal with it. She ends up going down there and Carter's so happy. Your girlfriend's here. He's like, my girlfriend, I have a girlfriend, and runs out and kisses her, which she did not ask for that, so trouble there. But I like her quip because she says, it's so expensive having a rich friend, which, because she's now given over $101 to him in one day.
It was the extra one. I mean, she could have been okay with 100.
Fine.
But that beautiful little moment, there's no hesitation. He comes out, arms around her, and he plants a kiss on her. And I'm just like, this is right. This is right. Yeah. I think these guys are wonderful together, Anna and
like
John. Now, obviously, we hate Anna, and we will have her removed from the show for you, Sharon. No problem.
Thank you.
But yes, just in this moment, I thought this was...
It worked.
Yeah.
It was, and obviously it's his relief as well, of like, he was literally thinking he was about to get... something happened to him and he's free and he's out and he's because he's been sitting there without any information and nobody kind of coming, and he's thinking, how long am I going to be in here? Forever, probably. And what I like about this as well is that it's art imitating life, because years later in 2012, Noah Wiley himself was arrested for protesting against Medicaid cuts. And I just love that he's just all these principles that are in him, and I'm very, very hot for somebody who has principles and stands up for them, and he does that.
I love him.
Honestly, how lovely is that? What I love as well is, because he's not the only one, George Clooney 5 weeks before that had been arrested at the Sudanese embassy, and so then when Wiley was being arrested, George Clooney was actually with his dad as well at the same time, so they were both arrested. So when Wiley was being arrested, he kind of said, after his arrest and people were interviewing him, he kind of said, let George focus on the international. I'll deal with the small domestic issues, which I thought was this really cute little connection back.
What's Anthony Edwards going to deal with?
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
I have no idea. Maybe he's, maybe it's not a prerequisite to deal with stuff. But I just thought that was just really cute that it happened in life,
definitely.
And out of and because he was actually quite a medical thing, that he was Medicaid, and it was all about healthcare and especially for people who are like elderly or disabled, which I just thought was, we love you, Noah Wiley, is what I'm trying to say. This episode for me was very wonderful. I just loved seeing Carter be all right, standing up for his belief, standing up for his patient, knowing, he says, I know my rights and I know my patience. And I just loved that. I loved that he stood firm, whereas somebody else might have just gone, here you go, here's the blood. So, yeah, that's the episode. Egg.
It is the episode. How about Ibers?
Yeah.
I've got
Chase Carter, who is played by Jonathan Scarfe, who
has May I just say, aged like a fine wine.
Really?
Oh my god. Yeah. Look, like, Ed, do yourself a favour. Oh my god. Google him now.
He's been in lots of things, Private Practice, Grimm, The Closer, Desperate Housewives. What I knew him from, actually from the 90s, was a show called Madison, which was this really cool Canadian. Yeah. It was a bit like Heartbreak High in that it was Canadian. It was like real issues. They would deal with real issues. And he was one of the teenagers and he was having an affair with an older woman. And lots of other things happened in it. They dealt with things like race and drugs and sexual assault, all that kind of stuff. But that's what I used to watch on Trouble in the 90s. And then he came into ER and I was like, oh, it's RJ. But there you go. That's what
he's in Van Helsing, which is something a show I was watching on Netflix and kind of gave up at the start of
pandemic.
That's it, because I thought I might be dead tomorrow. I stopped watching things I don't really like, which is a bit dramatic of me.
But I think good on you. Life's short. Man. Have fun. Really?
Yeah, although in the wrong company, life can be far too long. but he's been in a ton of stuff. He seems to be a kind of a serial guester in a lot of things. He's in like one episode.
Yeah.
But Ed, you might find this interesting. I just went on to his his little trivia there. His stepmother is Barbara March, who I believe played Lursa of the Duras sisters. Yes.
He was also in Data's Handbook in 2016, which with Meghan Markle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And also Terrell Rothery, who we know.
Oh, nice. I like her.
And she played a doctor again.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Okay. Right. Who else? I'm kind of flicking through, because there's a load of people who were in episodes before this we've already covered.
That's right. So we've got Hill Harper, haven't we, who played Mr. Jackson, and he's from things like Homeland, The Good Doctor, most recognisably from CSI New York, which he was in. I know him mostly from Skulls, which is a film with my other husband, Joshua Jackson, and the late Paul Walker.
Oh, yeah.
Hill Harper played Mr. Jackson and did it.
Another person who time obviously hit pause. God,
yeah, absolutely. He looks like that in everything he does, the same. And I want to know the secret.
Definitely.
Yes. But I don't know what's in the water, but I want it.
It's called a good lifestyle and access to Hollywood vitamins.
And you've already lost it. Well, yeah, you've lost me on both counts there, yeah.
So, speaking of that character, he suffered from a condition called sickle cell anemia, which, if you've studied any biology at school, you'll have learned a little bit about. It's a group of disorders known as sickle cell disease. It's basically where normally the flexible round red blood cells move easily through blood vessels, but in sickle cell, they're kind of shaped like a sickle or a crescent moon. And then they kind of get, there's also affects the way the hemoglobin is constructed inside the red blood cell. And it kind of slows down and blocks blood flow and oxygen to parts of the body. So you do get anemia, get these sort of episodes of pain where you've got a blocked blood vessel. And it also pain also occurs in your bones, which is, he said it's a migraine all over. And being a migraine sufferer, I can't imagine that. No wonder he was in desperate state.
Yeah, and I think he was trying to get out from under it, because he knew it would get worse, because he says, doesn't he, like it's going to get worse, like it's going to become full-blown.
But it's one of these genetic disorders that you can be a carrier for. I believe it's recessive, that's the word I'm looking for. So you need to have both genes from your parents for you to be a sufferer, but you can also have the hemoglobin trait if you inherit one version. So the normal hemoglobin gene, one defective form of the gene. So they do get they do have normal hemoglobin and sickle cell hemoglobin as well. So it's just not to the same extent, but they're just going to have to be aware when they, if they choose to have children, it might work, you know, checking if the other person's got the carrier.
Yeah,
is a carrier.
And actually, I was quite interested because I knew it kind of affected people kind of color more than it kind of the white people, and I wondered why and what that was about. And it's something to do with people from malaria-ridden countries, and they think it was some kind of form the way the blood worked to kind of
malaria just ended that now.
Which I thought was fascinating. And then obviously in genetics, and that gets passed out and as people migrate and all that and all that. So it's just something I'd always wondered. So when this came up, I thought, ooh, interesting.
I'd forgotten about that side of things. I think I'd studied it in A-level biology as well about, the connection between malaria and or populations with high risk of contracting malaria. And on that happy note, I whenever it's my episode, I feel like I end on a massive bummer. So
so Carter's beautiful. It's
nearly Carter's beautiful, and it's nearly Christmas.
Absolutely,
here are matches for beautiful Christmas. Special
Siri beautiful somehow Christmas. Picked up on nothing.
That is incredible.
she's just trying to help.
It's a boy Siri in my phone.
Oh, he's just trying to help. He's like, I'm going to help Ed be happy.
Yeah, thanks, Siri.
End happy, Christmas.
I think Christmas coming. Carter's a good guy.
Sharon loves him.
Sharon loves him. We all love him.
He reciprocates Sharon.
And also Peak Doug.
Peak Doug. Peak Doug. And Doug Bum. It's a good episode.
Okay, and we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget, you can find us on social media, on Instagram at You Set The Tone Pod, and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.